We will spend, do you guys think it's appropriate, Yulia, to spend half hour on this, then impairment half hour? Or how much time do you think, Sarah, you need for the impairment?
30 minutes. Okay. Okay, good afternoon, everyone.
Is Patrick sitting there has any meaning, or Patrick should sit here? Yeah, go ahead, Yulia.
You should all have the agenda paper on classification and measurement. So what I was going to propose is first to give a brief introduction and first talk about business model. And after we talk about business model, talk about modified contractual cash flow characteristic. Does it sound okay? Okay, fantastic. So just as a brief introduction, key objectives of replacing IAS 39 were to reduce complexity in accounting for financial instruments and also to develop a principle-based approach as opposed to a rules-based approach in IAS 39. Accordingly, under IFRS 9, classification and measurement of financial assets is based on two criteria, business model assessment and contractual cash flow characteristics assessment. The overriding idea is that if a financial asset has simple cash flows and it is held to collect those simple cash flows, then amortized cost will provide useful information about likely future cash flows. So the way it is articulated in IFRS 9, so if a financial asset is held to collect contractual cash flows and contractual cash flows represent only principal and interest, and interest is defined as a consideration for the time value of money and the credit risk, then this financial asset qualifies for amortized cost. Everything else is at fair value through P&L. Equities, derivatives, structured debt, fair value P&L is a residual category. Just to be clear, under IFRS 9, there is also an option to designate any equity investment other than held for trading at fair value through OCI on initial recognition. This election is irrevocable. So this is where IFRS 9 stands today. In November last year, the ISB decided to consider limited modifications to IFRS 9, and this is with the view of three objectives. First, to address the interaction with the insurance project. Second, to consider areas of convergence with FASB. And lastly, to address application feedback on IFRS 9 that we were aware of. In the agenda paper on page 3, there is a diagram that highlights the areas of change in IFRS 9. And the changes relate to business model assessment, contractual cash flow characteristics assessment, and the introduction of additional measurement category. So with that, I would like to turn to modified business model assessment in IFRS 9. The board has decided to introduce additional third measurement category for debt investments at fair value through OCI. This category will only be available for financial assets that meet contractual cash flow characteristics test, so this must be still simple assets. And the way we define the business model assessment for fair value OCI is a portfolio is held with a dual objective to both collect contractual cash flows and sell financial assets. A typical example would be a portfolio which is managed in order to maximize the yield. So on day one, the entity knows that some financial assets will be held, some financial assets will be sold to maximize the yield, but the entity does not know exactly how many will be held, how many will be sold, and which particular instruments would be either held or sold. Just to be clear, under IFRS 9 today, such portfolio would fall into fair value P&L because you cannot say that for portfolio as a whole, the objective is to hold to collect. Now it will fall at fair value through OCI. I guess the other important point I wanted to make about fair value OCI is the mechanics. Because we say there is a dual objective to hold and to sell, the board concluded that two sets of information are relevant. With that category, you get fair value on the balance sheet and amortized cost profile in P&L, because you have the same interest income recognition as for amortized cost, the same impairment recognition, and amounts are recycled. So you get two sets of information. I guess first I would like to understand if there are any questions for me, and then we can move on to the questions we have for you.
Any thoughts, any questions, Eugene?
Who's been complaining about the abolition of AFS, which presumably is where this comes from? Where is the pushback? Can you tell me more about the pushback? Because it's going down from 4 to 2, it's quite an achievement, and now we're going back up again. Instinctively, I'm not happy with. So why?
One of the key reasons for consideration of this category is the interaction with the insurance project. And insurers have told us that if there is no fair value OCI category for financial asset, they end up with significant volatility. So where we currently stand, given the decisions for financial assets and insurance liabilities, many of the insurers' financial assets portfolios will fall into fair value OCI. With respect to insurance liabilities, changes in insurance liabilities attributable to changes in discount rate will also go to fair value, will also go to OCI, and therefore their volatility concerns are addressed. With respect to the banking industry, and I know there is a lot of discussion going on at the moment in the banking community about this fair value OCI category, but we did to a very limited outreach as we were developing this category. And some banks told us that indeed they didn't think it was appropriate to put a portfolio, as in my example, which is being managed to maximize the yield at fair value P&L. And this is because they see a difference between a portfolio which is held for trading and held to maximize fair value changes and constantly bought and sold, as opposed to a portfolio which is not managed on fair value basis, and some assets are being held to collect contractual cash flows. So that's where we will come.
But there are also a lot of insurance companies who don't want to have OCI. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
I can jump into to Jen's point. In AFS, today you have both debt instruments and equity instruments. Equity instruments, there are people who complain that the impairment test when you recycle from OCI to P&L is difficult. The criteria for what triggers significant or prolonged impairment is a big issue, especially for regulators. And keep in mind that we have taken those equity instruments out of the AFS.
So
what we are left with is only debt instruments. And it is true that what we propose here doesn't seem that different from the current AFS for debt instruments. Mm-hmm. So to the question, if no one complains, yeah, what they have now is probably not that different.
And maybe if I could make one more point to your question. It sounds like that you are concerned a little bit about the complexity, and we used to have two categories, now we have three. But I guess the important point to keep in mind is that the mechanics of this fair value OCI category is different compared to the mechanics in old available for sale. So as I said, it is the same impairment model as for assets held at amortized cost, same interest income recognition. So we don't have the additional complexity from a different impairment model and the different mechanics altogether.
And with a portfolio, is it the issue that if they sold some, they then have to immediately class the whole lot as trading?
And under IFRS 9, if you have more than infrequent sales, you have to classify your portfolio at fair value through P&L. So infrequent sales are allowed.
Frequently, because it sounds as though if they're basically held for yield, but they're obviously tradable, so you could, so there's always a fair value available. Why wouldn't the infrequent sort of capture it? That you realise the gains when you actually do sell something.
But if you sell more than infrequently, you would be forced into fair value through P&L.
Yeah. I'll give you an example in our industry. Because we've got regulated asset retirement obligations, we have to commit specific funding to the regulator to pay for future rehabilitation obligations. Those are prescribed investments. They have to be in debt-funded equities. But the investment manager trades them because, of course, we need good yields so that we will have to fund lower cash flows in the future. At the moment, we're compelled through our income statement to record that in the income statement as regular earnings. But it's actually restricted cash to fund future obligations. So putting it through OCI cleans up our income statement instead of looking cluttered at the moment.
So it looks it's more like the pension fund?
Yes.
But you're not a bank?
No, we're a mining company.
So
that's a big difference.
Olivia, do you have anything to say?
I get my answer because I wonder if it was the same that available for sale accounting today. I think it's why it's what we say.
Okay, Martin.
Yeah, I can imagine that insurance companies that have matching liabilities have the desire to have them both in OCI, but maybe you can make that a condition that you can only apply the FVOCI if there is a matching liability. Because somehow, I don't want to be too lenient about changing fair value instruments that should be fair value just for the sake of tranquility to have something going through OCI. If there is a matching liability, I see the purpose. You can make that a condition, and you keep the fair value bucket as it is used, as it once was.
So you want to restrict it to those people? Perhaps you have insurance companies in mind, but you want to tailor it in such a fashion just only to those people who have an accounting mismatch because of their liabilities.
To be honest, if the example. If you have to put some restricted cash to fulfill an obligation, if you make a lot of money on that, that money will be yours. Not. It's not yours.
Because you've always got the liability to rehabilitate, so you're fundless, but you won't incur the income statement. It's a funding vehicle.
No, but Kevin, you have a liability of 100 and you have put a restricted cash of 100.
Yeah.
For some reason, you hit gold mine. Not in your mining industry,
yes.
But in the stock market.
Yeah.
100 became 200 in terms of restricted cash. I think Martin is asking, who gets that remaining 100? And the liability is still 100. And the 100 should go to the shareholders or should it go to the pension holders?
It's only repayable in all of the countries where we operate. It's only repayable at the future date when the mine is closed in 30 years' time. So
it will be yours.
Yeah.
It could reverse in the intervening period, and
but
therefore
But if it don't, it stays with you.
If I don't, it's an entity I get on. It's the amount I get on liquidation.
But if there is a significant amount that you would not be able to withdraw money from that,
not until closure occurs.
It's not
restricted.
You're
restricted until the end of my license.
Can you reduce future add on to the liability?
Yeah. No.
You cannot offset.
No.
But it's still restricted. It's ring-fenced only to fulfill that obligation. Anything extra goes back to the shareholders.
If there is a lack of money, do you need to put up more money?
Yes.
Okay, it's free-flowing.
Okay.
Yeah. Robert? So I've got a couple of... I'm not sure what you're trying to do, but I've already figured out some really good gaming things around it. So the first concept is, we're only going to do simple. And I said simple. Okay, simple means, simple actually, so if it's not senior debt, it's not simple. And I'll give you an example. I'm aware of a company, I'm not going to mention it here. They have basically on the balance sheet, what they have is 50% of their liability is debt. The other 50% is pension liability. The equity is zero. They literally have no equity or no substantial equity. The bonds are issued at 8%. They're non-investment grade. That bond is effectively equity because the equity guys are never going to get any money out. Only the bond players are going to get money out. And then we have this business of, well, we can trade back and forth. And I'm going, well, okay. We can have a portfolio of high risk debt. I can trade it back and forth. I can pick when I recognize the losses. You know, and all of it goes through OCI. Have I got this right?
Well, first of all, if you are, I guess a couple of things.
I must have missed something.
Okay. So first of all, when you talk about issued debt and you're saying there is no equity on the balance sheet, etc.
My point was that some simple debt has exactly the same risk payout profiles as equity. Exactly the same, because if you could define equity as the last as who gets the residual, mm-hmm. in a debt structure where you have senior debt and subordinated debt and huge amounts of liabilities, the residual will be going. In fact, in this particular example I'm giving, believe it or not, the residual is senior secured debt. They're the only people who are going to ever get anything. Everybody else is not getting anything, and so this idea of, okay, I'm only going to put simple debt instruments into this. Mm-hmm. If your insurance company puts in non-investment grade, and maybe insurance is not an example because it wouldn't be allowed to, it does have the payout profile of equity. And so I'm simplistically saying, if something with an equity payout should go through P&L, something that is called a bond should go through P&L too, by the same logic.
It seems to me you are questioning whether this instrument is a debt instrument or an equity instrument in substance.
No, I'm illustrating that the ring fence around this project has got two, what I perceive as two huge holes. We could meet your standard, what goes in there, and have an equity payout structure. And because we now can trade it back and forth, and typically these things don't, this type of instrument isn't very liquid, I can engineer when I recognize the profit and loss.
Well, I think there is a test whether the remuneration is solely principal and interest. Your assumption is that this instrument is not principal interest, it is equity.
Well, my.
So it might not meet the test to be at amortized cost. It may have to go to fair value somewhere, fair value OCI or fair value P&L. And then the question is whether the test of P&I would trigger fair value P&L, which is our proposal today, not fair value OCI.
And maybe just to clarify, so what is a simple instrument is actually defined in IFRS 9, right? And today, the way. And IFRS 9 today, if you are a simple instrument, you can get to amortized cost. So to your example, under IFRS 9 today, that instrument, if the conclusion is it meets solely principal and interest definition, it would go to amortized cost. So what we're changing now, instead of going to amortized cost, it might go to fair value OCI, depending on the business model. So I don't think we're changing anything to that respect, if it makes sense.
I think I'm going back to Jane's comment. I'm adding another category, and we're adding the ability to. The more categories, the more confusing it gets, the more difficult it gets to understand, and the more it. You know, we had four categories. And then we said, well, we can't move between categories. And then we started to say, okay, we can move between categories. We've gone now from two categories to three categories, and I'm illustrating, I think, that these categories are getting fuzzy. And so I'm going to echo again. I think I can explain how to game it. I'm echoing back to Jane's comment. What's the problem we're trying to fix, and is the solution worse than what we created? This sounded like a special deal for the insurance companies because they wanted to run something through OCI.
That's why Martin was making the comment. If that is the case, limit it to the liability, link it to liability. I think that's where Martin was making the comment. That don't open it to everyone, just link it to those people who have it. He will not call it insurance contract, but he will say, those people who have a liability of a particular nature. But I think that point is taken, but I think the staff is aware of that comment. This is not the first time the staff is hearing about it. Staff heard about it, and I think that's going to be in the basis of conclusion why we believe it.
Okay. One could say that this instrument is funded by liabilities which are at amortized costs on the balance sheet side of the liabilities. Hence, to say if it is funded by liabilities which are at fair value OCI only,
just misses the point when you fund with liabilities which are not at fair value on the balance sheet. So do we want to force all liabilities to get fair value on the balance sheet is another question.
Yeah, I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to get into that. Saichi, if you don't mind.
Two short questions. The first one is related to what Martin had said earlier. My question is that wasn't it possible to write it down in the insurance standards rather than writing it in the financial instruments? The second question is that the OCI equities, they are not recycled when they are sold, but this one, they would be recycled when they are sold. What was your rationale to make it a recyclable one for this one?
I guess a couple of things. So when the board discussed the fair value OCI option for equity instruments, the original idea was to limit this option to strategic investments. However, the board was not able to define strategic investments, and instead of giving this limited scope option, the board gave unlimited option to other than trading instruments. Prohibition of recycling on those equities, I think, had a twofold objective. First of all, it was a way to at least encourage people, preparers, to not overuse this category. So people would, because there is no recycling, you would only put an equity instrument at fair value OCI if you are not really holding it to realize fair value changes. So that was first rationale. And secondly, if these instruments were to be recycled, then we would have to think about impairment model for those equities. And impairment model for available for sale equities today is subject to a lot of criticism. So that was the logic for equity investments. With that, it is a different story. As I said, the board felt that because the portfolio is held to both collect cash flows and sell financial assets, two sets of information are relevant. It is important to get amortized cost profile and P&L and fair value on the balance sheet. To get amortized cost profile in P&L, you need to recycle, right, mathematically. And obviously, the issue about impairment model that arose for equity investments does not arise for debt investments because it will be the same expected loss model which is being developed by the board.
Saichi, I don't agree that the board does not have a recycling for equity instruments. You can give more dividends and recycle it. There is no prohibition there. So I think we all know where we got to, how we got to. I think it's personally I feel that Yulia is not going to say anything different. I think the equity instruments came about because one particular country wanted it to be on the equity, so the boards wanted to satisfy the requirement. And we had to come to a compromise. Some of us cried that day after going home. But for the answer we got to having dividend income statement, the other ones there, Microsoft never issues dividend. Why would it not be recycled? And GE gives in the dividend and it gets to income statement. And it's the wrong answer. But we got to where we got to. So let's move on to the other issues.
It was a compromise to be able to manage to simplify, take out complexity. Now we're adding back the complexity and leaving the compromise.
Yeah, it's a compromise, Saichi. You know more than anybody else. So let's move on to the next issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the interest of time, we need to talk about contractual cash flow characteristics assessment.
Could you answer me why you couldn't write it down in the
insurance
standards?
But should we not reserve the problem of Kevin?
Why not put the AFS on the insurance?
Well, we did think about it, but I guess the challenge is, you know, why would it only be for insurance companies or insurance contracts? What would be the logic behind that? And to Martin's comment, it's just a bit interesting, and we unfortunately do not have much time, but if we were to do an option, the question becomes, okay, well, is it an option out of amortized cost only, or is it also an option out of fair value through P&L? And historically, there was never an option out of fair value through P&L. You could only put things into fair value through P&L if the conditions were met. So I think immediately, you know, if something is at P&L and I'm now moving it to OCI, it just somehow doesn't feel right.
Also, to take Kevin's example, if you put it in insurance contract, Kevin's example will not be met. And that's economically a sensible answer to get to Kevin. So I think that putting it in insurance would not, come on, putting it in insurance does not solve the issue, and we don't want to make
it. That's only valid once we have defined what OCI is.
That's outside the scope of the limited.
Good job, Olya. Good job, Olya.
There is a further point.
I think this cannot be reduced to a board meeting, but I really think we should stick to time. Go ahead, Philippe. Of course, you need to.
There is a further point, Eichi. If you have an insurance company which has 100 in its liabilities and 10 in equity, and it has 110 as assets, financial assets, should we say we limit the use of OCI to the amount of 100 liabilities and the 10 which has counterpart as investments would not be okay? Or should we say 110, all the financial assets, because it is an insurance company, qualify for OCI? Then we have a special standard just because the company is named an insurance company. I don't think it's appropriate to make a difference based on the title of the company. So if we limit only to insurance contracts, the equivalent of assets to the insurance liability, then we have two models for the insurance company, for the assets.
And a lot of banks have insurance business, so you would really end up with an impossible situation.
Okay, Julia, you have 7 minutes to cover the rest of it.
Just try and very quickly explain what we changed in contractual cash flow characteristics and why, and then see what you think about disclosures. So basically, IFRS 9 says, okay, if you have principal and interest only, then you qualify for amortized cost. Interest is time value of money and credit risk. Now, there is an example in IFRS 9 which says, if you have an instrument with an interest rate mismatch feature, where you reset interest every month, but you reset it to a 3 month rate, there is a mismatch and this instrument fails. And people came back to it. So this example caused many people to interpret IFRS 9 very strictly. And we had all sorts of questions. Well, if my interest rate is based on a market average, do I fail? If I have just a little bit of a mismatch, just insignificant sort of variation in the time value of money, do I fail? And we decided to provide a minor amendment to IFRS 9 to accommodate instruments which are genuinely all about time value of money and credit risk, but there is a bit of mismatch. So the way we did it, I think the best way to think about it is in terms of building blocks. So if you have an instrument where you have principal, time value, and credit risk, and relationship is perfect, you pass. If you have an instrument where you have principal, time value, credit risk, and something else, equity link, commodity link, you fail regardless of how material it is because you can have variable cash flows. If you have principal, time value, and credit risk, but the relationship between these components is modified, is not perfect, then you need to assess the degree of modification. And if sort of modification compared to a perfect instrument is insignificant, then you pass. If it is more than insignificant, you fail. So this is essentially the change to IFRS 9 which the board has decided to make. Now the question arises, and this is a question with respect to disclosures. Given that this inherently introduces more judgment into IFRS 9, so it used to be black and white, and now we have this sort of gray where you have to assess. Do we need some special disclosures? And the board has not yet talked about disclosures, but what the staff has been thinking is that perhaps it would be a good idea to disclose the carrying value of the instruments where you applied judgment, and perhaps it would be a good idea to explain the terms of those instruments and why the entity decided that it is still simple instrument, still solely P&I. Do you think those disclosures would be helpful, and do you think there are any other disclosures that should accompany such instruments?
I just want to say one comment, though. When she talked about the three building blocks that we need to think about, principal, time value of money, and credit risk, we are talking only the credit risk of the issuer, not the credit risk having, I cannot issue a stock, a debt instrument, credit risk to GE or something like that. It's credit risk of the issuer. I just want to be very clear on that. Yes, Martin.
Yeah, just conceptually, I just wonder whether it is possible to really point out the components of a financial instrument. There could be liquidity discount in there, there could be any kind of discount in there, and I'm not sure whether you can be certain that in any financial asset that the components are limited to principal consideration for time, value of money, and credit risk. So conceptually, I just wonder, how can you ever be certain that there's no liquidity premium or discount, or discount usually, in the asset?
Well, I guess a couple of things in response to that. Firstly, you will definitely know if there is something else, right, to the interest rate, if there is, you know, indexation to equity prices, commodities, things like that. And secondly, basis for conclusions to IFRS 9 does talk about liquidity risk, and it is sort of an allowed component within the interest rate. And the whole idea is, are you getting the appropriate return? Are you just being compensated for the time value and credit risk? Or are there other things going on? Are you trying to gamble on some other market variables as part of what you describe as just interest? Does this answer your question?
No.
You're doing a building block, Professor. The time value of money is the risk-free rate, and then premiums to the risk-free rate for this that go beyond credit. You know, there's things like, you know, a retail borrower gets who's incredibly good credit risk will be charged a higher rate of interest than a corporate will be, because it's a small ticket. There's increased cost to serve that individual. So there's actually elements of the interest charge that reflect the fact that it's burdensome to service that individual. And it's not just time value of money.
Yeah. We're just saying that as long as it is linked to the issuer, it doesn't have any other features than that, it's okay. The issue came, Martin, and in the interest of time, is that when you look at the instrument B in our application guidance, there is a lot of interpretation that came about in the marketplace that we were trying to address that. And also, personally for me, this is a one way to get over the criticism to some extent about componentizing the instruments between the hybrid instruments. So this takes away some pressure of it, when the way board did it, just to make sure that more qualify for amortized cost as long as they do have these three elements that she mentioned. Because otherwise you will get into more splitting or more fair value, which may not be the intention. That's what is the approach of the board, in my mind. That's how I voted, at least.
And I'd like to remind everybody that we're talking about limited modifications to IFRS 9. So there are things which are already embedded in the standard. We got feedback. It was subject to due process. So we are only talking about what we changed, not overall.
Any other question to Yulia? I know it's getting late in the day, but thank you, Gerard.
Just a small question. When you say that the modification between the instrument you try to evaluate and the plain instrument, simple instrument, you say the modification is not more than insignificant. What do you compare practically?
So basically what you need to do, and we will need to think a bit more how we articulate it, but basically what you need to do, you need to say, okay, so here's my instrument where I have, for example, a mismatch between frequency of reset and the tenor of the rate. Well, if my instrument were to be reset each month to a monthly rate, what compensation I would be getting?
Okay.
And to compare whether economically what you are getting is still consistent with the return on a perfect instrument.
Okay. Let's suppose that once you have done the computation,
you arrive to the conclusion that this difference is 10 basis points, let's suppose. We have done some computation, and we are not very far from that that figure. You compare this 10 basis points to what? The full rate that you would charge a customer with a simple instrument or anything else?
I think I have a suggestion that may alleviate problems. If you change if a financial asset into if the contractual cash flows of a financial asset, then you probably solved it. Contractual cash flows of a financial asset can consist of principal, interest.
In the standard it does talk about contractual cash flows.
Yeah, it's not here in the text, but so then.
But Gerard, you're asking what do you compare it to? If you've concluded that the original instrument met the cash flow characteristics test, then the modified instrument is being compared to that original instrument.
Yes, but the interest rate charged to this original interest, if you charge a customer for a simple instrument, let's say 300 basis points,
right,
including time, value of money, and credit risk, and some more elements, margin, for example, in that case, 10 basis points enter in the expression not more than insignificant. But if in your mind you compare to something else and the margin, for example, it can be significant in that case.
Well, you compare the instrument under the assessment to exactly the same instrument except for the feature under the assessment. So it's not another instrument in the market which is, you know, with a different issuer. So it is this instrument versus what it would have been if it didn't contain this mismatch, for example.
Well, so it's not a component. You don't componentize the bit that is modified and isolate it to compare to what it would be unmodified. You take the whole two instruments and
yes.
You compare to each other. You
yes.
don't have to try to identify this bit, which is not exactly the same as a benchmark, and do the comparison at this level.
Yes. Yeah.
I think if you look at the instrument B, isn't it instrument
yes.
B? Take a look at instrument B in the application guidance we have, and you see what we are trying to do is to help in those situations to get to amortized cost. That's all we are trying to do. And it's like Yulia mentioned, it is a limited thing. We don't intend to broaden this to make it everything wide. I know we are running short. Yes, Neri.
How do you think about structured products that are getting modification of cash flow, a bunch of mortgage-backed securities, where you slice and dice, and then you don't have the traditional principal or interest, but you get an allocation of cash flows from a basket of fixed income securities?
You have various tranches, right, in that?
You got a bunch of tranches, and then you find different things becoming different principal than the underlying mortgages, and those are sometimes pass through certificates, but sometimes they pass through the income and based on different tranches. And you can modify what the original traditional principal and interest to simply an IO, a PO. Those are fixed income interest, but you get a bunch of modifications. Would this be ever eligible?
We have specific guidance in IFRS 9 today, and we're not reconsidering it, which has to do with concentration of credit risk and contractually linked instruments. And the short answer is that basically, if your tranche, well, there is a bunch of criteria. There is like 2 pages of application guidance. But basically, if your credit risk in the tranche that you are holding is not higher than the average credit risk in the underlying pool of assets, and, you know, there is a number of other criteria, then you pass. So sort of more senior tranches have a chance to pass, and more junior tranches would fail.
Isn't it a look-through scenario? You need to look
yeah,
through.
Yeah.
You need to look through to do it. It was heavily debated in the issuance of IFRS 9, and it's like a look-through. And as you move in the tranches, you get to less and less amortized cost, and more to the fair value. With that, I want to thank Yulia. Thanks, Yulia. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And we will have the next team to come and talk us upon impairment. Ooh, I didn't mean it. So, I'll come to them.